You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome, wiretappers, back here in the studio of Gangland Wire. Got our good friend and co-host Cam Robinson on the line with us. Hi, Cam. How you doing?
Hey, Gary. How you doing? I'm glad to be back.
Well, good. You know, we were talking on the phone about something else. I've been really tied up, as you know, Cam, on finishing that movie off that I've been working on, the Spiro-Civella War, or Civella-Spiro War here in Kansas City. We've got our Kansas City Mafia Film Festival coming up on November the 15th, 16th, and 17th. That'll be two screenings of Gangland Wire and Black Hand Strong Man, which is basically a history of both of them. Between the two of them, it's a history of the entire scope of Kansas City organized crime. And then Saturday, I'm going to show my new movie. It's called Brothers Against Brothers, the Civella-Spiro War. And we'll show that and then take questions afterwards. And I'll have my FBI agent friend, Bill Lousy, will come over and he'll answer some questions and I'll answer questions. So we'll do kind of a panel. Then we have an interesting little video that my co-host of the film festival, Terrence O'Malley, who did Black Hand Strong Man, he got his hands on a short 10 or 15 minute videotape of a guy who was in the witness protection program that came back into Kansas City and drove around with a friend of his and pointed out different sites. Like, you know, he was not a mob guy. His dad was a mob guy and his dad got killed. And then they went after him too. And he ended up testifying against a couple of people and went into witness protection. But he drives around saying, I saw my dad kill a guy here and my dad did this there and my dad did that there. So Terrence, he got it from a family member several years ago. This all happened back in the 60s and 70s that he's talking about. And it was the 80s that he came back into town. He's since committed suicide, actually, about 7 or 8 years ago. But his name was Freddie Bonadonna. Terrence is going to show that, and then we're just going to have a kind of a panel discussion with Owsley and myself and Terrence about the things that he talked about seeing and that his dad did, and kind of the implications of organized crime on the families, the family members of people in Kansas City. Because, you know, Bill always says that the reason we've never had any really good witnesses that came in and went in witness protection was because it's Kansas City, such a small town. Everybody mm-hmm. knows everybody, and their extended families know each other. And so if you go into witness protection, and Freddie did, he didn't have a choice. They were going to kill him. He might as well get something out of it.
They killed his father, right?
They killed David. His father, yeah. They killed David, and they were going to kill him. He leaves town, so he's got this large extended family that have to live with this kind of the onus mm-hmm. of him being a rat for, you know, the rest of their lives. And it's like I said, they go to each other's weddings and funerals and see people at each other at church and, you know, the neighborhoods, and their kids go to the same school and then their grandkids go to the same school. So, you know, it's a little different. Chicago is a great big city or New York and Northeast areas. It's such huge areas that you can move across the borough to another borough and never even hear or see of the person again and disappear. But not in Kansas City. There's even move out in the suburbs. There's no way to get away from each other in Kansas City. So having said all that, Kim and I were talking about kind of the genesis of the mob influence in Las Vegas and the difference in why does Chicago have so much influence in Las Vegas and the New York crime families have had little interest in it, when in fact the New York crime families are some of the early players out there. Mm-hmm. So as we were talking about this, and he found a really good resource on a meeting that was held, and I said, you know, let's do a podcast on that, and I want to get it out pretty quick because I have some people I want to thank. Let me get my paper here.
A lot of really good messages on there. I checked the YouTube, and you get a lot of really good followers, Gary. I really like the feedback that you get.
Yeah, we do. We really, and you've helped a lot. They seem to like you, Cam. I should really be jealous. They never said they like me.
I really appreciate it.
But anyhow, from Venmo, you know, I'm always talking about buy me a cup of coffee or a shot and a beer. From Venmo on the app, Johnny Good, he bought me a shot and a beer. And he said that he thought the podcast was great, and he had just taken the Frank Calabrese tour up in Chicago, and he loved it. So if any of you
great
people
tour.
Go to Chicago, look up the Frank Calabrese, I think it's called the Family Secrets Tour, isn't it?
Family Secrets Tour, yeah.
Family
yeah,
Secrets
great tour.
And I understand it's really good. We got, here's another guy from Chicago, is on YouTube, called himself Joey Cigars, and the name looked like it was Joe Schutz. Now, we're not sure if he has a cigar store or what up there, but he said, I'm truly enjoying every new show while outside smoking a cigar, even though it's 40 degrees in Chicago. Keep up the good work. You and Cam work together really well. So that's thanks a lot there, Joy Cigars. And for all you cigar smokers out there, think about when you got to go outside, when the wife makes you go outside to smoke the cigar. That's such a cliche, but you know that happens all the time.
I smoke mine in the garage when I'm working on the car doing doing my work, yep.
All right, so when you're out there, when you're banished from the house to smoke your cigar, why, stick your earbuds, there it is, stick your earbuds in and listen to another one of the podcasts. Tennis Ball, he said he really thought that Cam was really knowledgeable about organized crime, and that's true, folks. He is really knowledgeable about it, and he's a great researcher. And if he wants to know something, he knows where to go. That's the key. I learned that in law school. You never have all the answers, mm-hmm. but you do know how to find the answers. That's the most important thing, is the skill to find the answers. And Cam can find the answers and dig up those stories. We got some other things. Mark Ryan, he's a regular. Thanks a lot. He's last one. He said thanks a lot for. Help. I'll correction on that. Mark Ryan said, thank you for all the great podcast. And he said he was helping me out with out-of-pocket expenses. So thanks, Mark. Alan Turner, he just says, thank you. But he does have a suggestion. And this is one I don't think I mentioned to you, Cam. Mm-hmm. But I think it'd be a pretty good story. There's some resources out there for this. He said his uncle was an Al Capone lieutenant named Jaime Loudmouth Levin. Have you ever mm-hmm. heard of Jaime Loudmouth Levin? He was a pretty big deal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was a big deal. There's several things out there on him. He has a pretty good story. He had one of the wire services, you know, the wire services
yeah.
back then in the 30s and 40s. On up in the 50s, they
took him over
these.
From Bo Annenberg.
Oh, yeah. And mm-hmm. They delivered the horse racing results. So you'd have these different betting parlors in different cities. We had a wire service here in Kansas City, or one that came into a cigar stand, and they had to take horse racing bets so you would know the results of the races throughout the United States. This was kind of before sports betting was so big, and it was mainly horse race betting if you're going to bet on some contest that was not happening in your city.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a school of thought that says that's why Bugsy Siegel was killed, because he was messing with Chicago's wire. And, you know, some obviously some people say the East Coast, but you know, Virginia Hill was she worked for Chicago, and it was at her place. So there are those who say that Chicago had a hand in taking out Bugsy
really?
Siegel. That's right, over that wire service that his family member took part in, that Jaime Levin.
All right, cool. So we may have to look into
absolutely
Jaime Loudmouth Levin. Another Venmo person, Frank Sanchez, said he loves a podcast from somewhere in Texas, so keep them coming. On YouTube, Eileen Robinson said, I really enjoy the humorous comments that you guys bring to the podcast. So we try to keep it light and funny.
She sounds like a wonderful woman.
Wonderful woman. Anybody that says something good about us, we like them, don't we?
Anyone with the same last name as myself.
Oh, yeah, I tried. I didn't think about that. Oh, is that your Eileen Robinson? Is that your wife?
Eileen is my
or
is
your
my
sister?
Mother. She is
your
my
mother.
A delightful woman.
Good. Well, Red Wombat, our good friend, former outfit Some people call him a rat. I call him an undercover agent because he went to the FBI and volunteered his time to go in and work on some of the baddest people up there. And Frank Suisse was one of the baddest of the bad and one of the most dangerous men up there.
That's right.
Man, he didn't have the ability to order somebody else to kill you, but he could do it himself. And he carried out a lot of other contracts for like Sam Giancana and some of those guys up there. Mm-hmm. So Red Mehmet says, great podcast. Of course, that one was probably about him. I probably mentioned him, but anyhow, he's my friend. I talk to him every once in a while. He's a great source. So anyhow, that's all the thank yous I've got. Let's get on to the show here. And we were talking about this just before we started recording here. And as I look back, I think... I know in my movie Gangland Wire, I had one of my experts. It's about skimming from Las Vegas. And I had an expert, Michael Green, who is a mob historian from Las Vegas, teaches at UNLV out there. And he made the quote, and of course I put it in the movie because it was too good not to, that he understood that Chicago and the East Coast mobs had all had a meeting and decided to divide up the action. The East Coast mobs could take care of all the action coming out of the Atlantic City casinos, mm-hmm. and Chicago would get everything coming out of Las Vegas, which makes sense, but it's much more complicated than that. And that meeting happened about the time that we served the search warrants here in Kansas City. You know, I went into Carl DeLuna's house and helped search his house and found all the notes. I didn't find them. Somebody else found them, actually. Found all the notes that he'd kept on keeping books on how much the skim was and who was getting how much, and even his books on how much it cost him to fly out and fly back. I guess he got reimbursed or something. As they said in the movie Casino, what are you going to keep books for? Are you paying taxes?
Yeah, for y'all, that scene is in the movie Casino where they storm in his house, and the guy who's Tuffy DeLuna has a heart attack, which didn't happen, but
no.
that was one of those guys unseen was Gary walking in the door. So.
Yeah, really. Actually, Tuffy didn't have a heart attack. He was cool as a cucumber, man. He was like, he told his wife, she was getting upset, and he said, no, he said, Sandy, just settle down. He said, you know, these guys are just here to do their job. He says, you know, he said, why don't you make some coffee for the officers? So she hustles around and starts making us coffee. And we were there. We got there about 8 o'clock at night. We were there till 4 o'clock in the morning. Oh, man. It was a long night for the DeLuna family. She ended up leaving, and his son was there, his teenage son. He got all upset, and they made him leave pretty early. And so it was a long night for all of us, but it was really a long night for Tuffy.
Man.
You know, one of the little unknown things. They're searching around. They're finding different things. And he knows they're going to go through everything. And he tells one of the FBI agents that he knows, his name was Shay. He said, Shay, he said, you might as well go down the basements. That's where the good stuff is. And that's where they found the notes that he'd kept.
Man.
So anyhow, I digress. Let's start talking about there was a meeting. It was a little later than what I thought, but there was a meeting. It would have been about, like I said, about the time or slightly after the time that we served the search warrants and it started getting exposed. I don't know, right after we served the search warrants, they didn't know how deep that the FBI was into all of them at that point in time. But they did divvy up this thing. So what do you remember about that meeting? Where was that? It was back east somewhere.
It was in Philadelphia. It may have been a little bit earlier than what I found. The information on it basically came from law enforcement and some underworld sources, and you know they can pinpoint it as well as you want to think. But apparently in Philadelphia, there was. Let's see, gambling in Atlantic City was 1976, and it would have taken them a while to get the casinos built. So I guess around that time, if they were running guys out of Las Vegas, then they'd want to look to Atlantic City. So sometime around 78 or 79 in Philadelphia, there was a meeting. And I guess the Eastern families, the five families in New York and in Philadelphia, the sixth group, had decided that they were going to leave Chicago out of it and just give Chicago Las Vegas, and they were going to take Atlantic City. That Chicago was not a part of that decision, and they were kind of miffed about it. I guess that's against the commission rules to kick somebody out. So they called this big meeting to be held in Philadelphia, and you had members of the outfit there. Apparently the Genovese, the Bruno family in Philadelphia, and from what I found, it says the Lucchese's, the Gambinos, the Columbos, and the Bonanos all had people at this big meeting. If it were a big commission meeting, that would have been the case. They said that the Zerillis were not there. I guess that Joe Zerilli had just died recently, so things were in a little bit of an uproar in Detroit, and.
Yeah, Detroit should have been there because Detroit had interest in Morris Schenker in the Aladdin, I believe.
Aladdin, yeah. And they were in with St. Louis
Morris Schenker, he was a lawyer out of St. He was a lawyer out of St. Louis.
That's right.
Matter of fact, he was a guy that I don't want to digress too far, but there's a. On my YouTube page, there's a famous audio of Joey Lombardo threatening Morris Schenker because he should have kicked back some money to Alan Dorfman, and he hadn't done it. And he just acted like a crazy old man, I noticed.
That's right. That's right.
and he outlived them all. He died of natural causes.
Absolutely. But they got together, and it was a six-hour dinner they had in a Philly restaurant. This was while Bruno was still alive, Angelo Bruno. And they agreed that Chicago would stay out of Atlantic City, and they would turn over all interests in Las Vegas to Chicago, anything on the street, anything that was going on. So I guess that's where you hear Spilotro had control over the streets, and that was... I guess he had been, there must have been some sort of agreement earlier because he had been running the streets for a long time up to that point. And I've heard interviews with Colada, Frank Colada, where he says that Spilotro had connections back east and that he had the okay to take over the streets. And there is a scene in Casino. I've not read Casino, the book, but there is a scene in that where there's some guys checking out, getting some money, and the voiceover says, out of respect, guys from other crews got a warning, and then the guys, they say something about Carmine. He said Carmine's left, and so they walk out too. I guess Nicky Santoro, Tony Spilotro character, sees these guys out of the hotel. So we do have a couple of sources verifying this, and this came out of the. I found this in the Tribune, in the Times, and a couple other places. So they did have a big sit-down. It was a six-hour dinner. They flew in from Chicago and all over. And Chicago apparently agreed because I've never heard anything about anybody in Atlantic City besides Scarfo. And there was some fighting between the Gambinos and the Genovese about who was going to take over parts of New Jersey. I know the Lucchese's were pretty heavy in New Jersey, but nothing about Chicago and Atlantic City that I've ever heard.
And now, those Northeast families, there was all of them wanted something Atlantic City. There was so much money to be had down there, but at the start, they made it a little bit difficult. The Gaming Commission was really was up and ready for it. They already had the experience of our experiences in Las Vegas and kind of how that worked when you let them get in the casino. So their gaming control board was a little bit stringent early on.
Yeah,
I think the politics probably took hold. But and so what they did is they started getting into all the ancillary businesses around the casino and unions and stuff. And they took them a while to really move in. When they moved in, they finally were really in tight, but it took a while because they were really up and ready for them.
Mm-hmm. That's right. The concrete pouring and rebarb and the restaurant workers union and they really had a footing, and that was because Scarfo had been there since the 60s. It was kind of a slap in the face to send somebody to Atlantic City because the town had been dead for a while.
Yeah,
but. All of a sudden, it becomes the gambling mecca of the East Coast, and he goes from nobody to a real player. So It would have been interesting to know who was at this meeting. I think you can sort of spitball who might have been in attendance based on different factors and who was who at the time. But it wouldn't be any more than a guess unless you could find some sort of Freedom of Information Act, and then you'd have to know something to know who to pinpoint to get it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would...
You may never know, but I did notice that, I guess it was the Trib had reported that aides from Tony Arcardo and Joy Iupa came, and so we were speculating about that. That more than likely at this point in time, it probably would have been like Jackie Cerrone or somebody like that.
That's what I was thinking, yeah, because...
He was the smarter of everybody,
he was Accardo's guy, too.
Yeah, he was Accardo's guy. He used to be his driver. That's how he came up. He didn't quite have the zing to be the boss up there. They looked at him for that a little bit, but he never had that kind of charisma or anything, and the brains to be the boss. But he would be the kind of guy that you would send on a deal like that. Lombardo possibly, because Lombardo definitely, Splatro and Lombardo had a relationship.
Yeah, Grand Avenue crew.
Grand Avenue crew, and because of Las Vegas, Splatro was out there on the streets, but Lombardo was in Alan Dorfman's office.
That's right.
And that's where all the money was coming from, and Joy Lombardo went over there like every day. I've got tons of audio from him sitting around there talking with Dorfman, and God, you can't make sense. I mean, you can make sense of it. It was just mainly about Teamster stuff. There was nothing real sexy about it. And then they'd get Splatro on the phone every once in a while, and then he was in there one time. But that was he was really intimately involved with the whole Las Vegas scene, I would say, from the Chicago area. He would have been the point man in Chicago, I would say.
And when did Roy Lee Williams turn over to Jackie Presser? Do you remember the year? It would have been around that time. It might have been a little bit later.
He was getting sick.
Yeah.
And the whole skim case was going down. He had emphysema really bad, and it was getting bad enough he was carrying the oxygen around. And then when the charges were filed, it was about 1980-81, I would say, is when Jackie Presser went in.
Okay.
And then he's charged, with crimes, so he's got to, he's got to get out of the Teamsters Union, or at least leave that position by 1980 or 81, and he's dying too. So then he turns informant, and what was really interesting is not informant, but witness, and he died shortly thereafter. But all during this time, Jackie Presser is a top echelon informant for a couple of agents
in
Cleveland.
That's right.
I tell you, they had that thing wired. Then they had in the end, they had two of the three main characters, Presser, Williams, and Alan Dorfman. Two of them were FBI sources. Only Dorfman wasn't, but they killed him just in case.
That's right. I was wondering, like you said, Lombardo would have been up on the Teamsters. He would have been up on Vegas. Cerrone, I know he did go to New York a couple times later when they were talking about, he was unhappy with Jackie Presser's performance. So I know that Cerrone did travel to New York. And I know Tony Salerno had connections to Chicago when they were looking to get Jackie Presser in as the head of the Teamsters. He talked about reaching out to Iupa and Cerrone. So there are historical ties between the Genovese and Chicago. So I know all who was in charge of Jersey at the time for the Lucchese's in the Genovese. You had Abate and Tumac Asituro, who were in charge of Jersey for the Lucchese family. It's hard to imagine that the commission would have all gotten together in one place as late as 79. Too damn risky.
Yeah, I think they've learned their lesson by now. They're really, really careful about that big of a meeting. We watched them have meetings just between us and Chicago, and they were so, so careful. The Bureau had a bug in this Chicago policeman's house, who was a nephew of Nick Savella, actually, and he was going to meet Joey Iupa and I think Jackie Cerrone there, and the bug was set. Corky and Cork and Nick Savella arrived. They go in. Iupa and Cerrone gets there. They go in and they bug the second floor room is a brownstone with three floors. They bug the second floor because that's where kind of like where the main room would be, and that's where they thought it was going to be, and they didn't go up the stairs. Iupa had a heart problem, and by that point in time, wouldn't go up the stairs. They stayed downstairs, but it really, like, on the I've got the telephone call, and it's all in Sicilian, and Nick's telling his nephew, called him Stomp, name was, I said, Anthony Sciobola. He said Stomp, he wanted Lambrusco wine, and he wanted some antipasto, And he wanted it all just right, and he wanted to make sure that his other relatives were out of the house when this was happening, and his son was going to be out what they call sweeping the streets. So his son was also a Chicago policeman, and he was out looking all up and down the streets trying to find any surveillance. So these guys just are super, super careful when they have these meetings.
You know, that's something I run into a lot reading about Chicago, and I know that a lot of the listeners will be familiar also. You find former Chicago police officer, former deputy, former, whenever you run into these guys, you're not too far removed from one. A former officer is now working for the outfit. There's, and I don't mean to speak ill of the Chicago Police Department, but anytime you've got a city where you have heavy mafia presence, you're going to run into some corrupt officers in some capacity, whether it's politicians, whatever, but it seemed to get a lot of them in Chicago.
Yeah, they got it. You know, it was corruption in the entire city government. Chicago was pretty endemic, whether it be the police or the courts or whatever it was. Another thing I'd like to talk, let's talk a little bit about this street crime and bookmakers and everything in Las Vegas that Tony Splatro. And loan sharking. Tony Splatro, he had money on the streets. I've talked to a guy named Ernie DeVino, who was originally from New Jersey but had gone out to Las Vegas, in the later 60s, I think, early 70s, and was a career criminal out there and just kind of freelancing out there and doing different burglaries. And he fell in with Splatro's hole-in-the-wall gang. And, you know, we're doing the high-end burglaries for him. I don't think Tony ever went on him. That's when Frank Collado led that crew. And by the way, an aside, Frank Collado and Ernie DeVino do not like each other today. DeVino never talked. Frank Collado talked, but Ernie DeVino never talked. Now, he doesn't make any references to the fact that Collado went into witness protection and talked. But he doesn't like him today, and so that's just an interesting little thing, I think.
Contributing factor.
But he was talking about, he told me once I got hooked up with Tony Splatro, he said money just started coming my way. He had some of his own loan shark money out there, he said, and it was just like Tony owned that city. And once you became part of his crew, then you got what you wanted. It became known in that underworld that you were part of Splatro's crew, and everybody else fell in line. Mm-hmm. And like getting tipsters to set up marks, where they'd be fat cats that they could fleece in some kind of a card game or somebody that had had connections in the hotels and knew where somebody would have had a big stash of money or jewelry or something in a hotel room that was out on the strip. You know, Splatro's crew could find out that stuff. They had that town wired. Mm-hmm. And so I guess, like you said in the movie, if an independent crew came to town and tried to do those kinds of things, and especially if they better not do anything at the Stardust, I know that, or at the Tropicana. Yeah, because Kansas City owned the Tropicana, and Kansas City, Chicago, and Milwaukee, and Cleveland owned the Stardust. But in some of the other hotels, independent operators came in and tried to do something. If they found out about it, they were going to be called into Splatro's Gold Rush Jewelry, is my understanding. And he either got a piece of the action or they had to hit the road. It's interesting how then that little subculture, how much control. It's such a small world, I guess. especially like Las Vegas is like Kansas City. It's not that big. So mm-hmm. if you come in and make some kind of a big score, everybody's going to know it. And everybody's going to be start trying to figure it out. And it isn't going to be long before they're going to know who it is because they had that town wired up, man.
Well, just across, it seems to be a small world anyway. All these guys know each other pretty much across New York, across Chicago. You hear Colada talk, he knows all these guys. And the information that, you know, a guy like Greg Scarpa, he was pretty high up. But anything happened, any time anything happened across the city, he knew about it. So it's, I think that, and you could speak to this better than I, but it sounds like the underworld is relatively a small world as it is. Everybody seems to know everything that's going on. They seems to be a hell of a grapevine. Whenever a job's pulled, they seem to have a good idea what's going on.
When it's a significant job,
yeah.
When it's a job that takes some skill, they're probably going to know. And there's just not that many of those real independent operators because, you know, to pull a job, say come out of a city and go to another city and pull a really good job. Well, you got to case the place. You got to figure out, you know, what's worth taking. Mm-hmm. And how you do it and everything. And so that's why you got to work with other people from other cities. If you're going to travel down to Phoenix to do something, then you probably ought to connect up with somebody down there to get the lay of the land. And even though you may have a tip, you still need to know, you know, some local knowledge, I would say, like we say on the golf course, got local knowledge about the golf course. You need some local knowledge about the city, and once you start asking for that local knowledge, then the word's going to spread that you're in town to do something.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's funny. In my job, I've had to go to Cleveland, I've had to go other places to do different audits and things, and first thing you do is you touch base with the local guys, and then they know you're around. But it's funny how that translates to any kind of economy, whether it's the criminal or whether it's any kind of a, like you said, whether it's a golf course, it's the criminal economy works the same as the regular economy.
Really, really. So one more thing about this Philadelphia Bob Conference, and that's, and I'd heard this before, that's the meeting where it came out that it was allowed for Angelo Bruno to be killed. So let's talk a little bit about that, the Bruno family and how that went down.
Well, from what I understand, Bruno was probably at this meeting, but as far as Bruno being killed, I think that had a little bit more to do with the Genovese wanted more power in Jersey, and that was where they were kind of, you know, I think it's like in Shakespeare, can anybody rid me of this troublesome priest?
Yeah.
And that was when Caponigro went and he did have Bruno killed, and then when he went up to get his approval to be the boss, they said, we didn't tell you to kill him. We said just do whatever you had to do. They didn't give you and so that, in getting rid of Bruno, who was tight with the Gambinos, they supplanted him with Testa, and then with Scarfa, who were both tight with the Genoveses. Mm-hmm. So I think that this allowed if anything, this meeting allowed the Genovese to clear the way by keeping Chicago out of the equation and by getting the lay of the land to see who was going to be what, so that they could really see if they'd have to get rid of Bruno. But yeah, that was definitely a play by the Genovese to get rid of the Gambino.
It probably paved their way and made it a lot easier for them to move into Atlantic City and big money at the casinos. You know, that's another thing. Is there's two different levels of crime going on, and everybody can't handle that upper level. That upper level of getting involved with a huge big corporation, $100 million corporation, $100 million business, and getting in there far enough, and then being able to siphon that big money out of there. You know, these guys that go out and collect loan shark debts and take sports bets and go out and strong arm people and extort money from people, they aren't the same guys. You don't do that stuff when you're going after people in a corporation where there's a hierarchy and there's a lot of square john employees. That takes a lot more sophistication, and the bosses are going to have to be in control of that, and they're going to have to pick specific people. I was always surprised about this whole Splatro thing, sending him out to do that. But they see, we're forgetting about Lefty Rosenthal.
Yeah.
He was a guy with the knowledge. He was a guy with the connections. He was a guy who could go in and set all that up. Splatro was not a guy who could go in. He was more of a street guy.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, Chicago always had that set up. They had Gus Greenbaum running casinos back in early day before Howard Hughes bought them all, and then they had Caifano running the streets. So they always had that street level guy, and they always had, and it was usually a Jewish guy running the casinos and a street guy, you know, Italian guy out running the streets. So that was going back to Mo Dalitz and. It was. They always had the Jewish guys running the casinos, and then they had the street guys.
Yeah, that's an interesting insight. Our comparison is Marshall Caifano or Johnny Roselli and Gus Greenbaum and Mo Dalitz back then. And in modern times, it was Lefty Rosenthal, Frank Rosenthal, and Tony Splatro.
That's really,
I never really thought about it like that. Yeah. It's really interesting. You know, one of the wiretaps, Nick Savella is talking with their mole out there, a guy named Joe Augusto, who was really ensconced into the Tropicana, and he was kind of an unknown, and he ended up turning witness for the FBI and died of a heart attack kind of in the middle of the trial. So he was an unknown totally before this. Mm-hmm. But he, oh God, I just lost my train of thought.
Call between Savella and Augusto.
Oh yeah, and so they were talking on the phone. Yeah, thank you. they were talking on the phone and talking about who they could deal with out there. And Nick Savella said, "What about Mo Dalitz?" He said, "I can deal with him." And Joe Augusto said, "Oh yeah, he's a good man. That Mo Dalitz, we can do business with him." And you know what that means when it says we can do business with him? So that's that's kind of how it works. We've kind of left Mayor Lansky out of this. He had a lot to do, I think, early on, him and Frank Costello.
Yeah.
And the New York families getting their hooks into Las Vegas casinos. You know, that there was that hit on Frank Costello, or attempted hit. They attempted murder him. It was that the guy they called the Chin, Vincent Gigante, and he messed it up. And Frank Costello refused to identify him or testify or anything, and actually Gigante had hired a guy to do it, and Frank Costello even apologized to the guy and said, I can't remember how it went down,
Gigante was walking past. He said, "Sorry, Frank."
Yeah, that was it. So I got that backwards, but anyhow.
Genovese sent Chin.
When they searched his pockets at the hospital, they came out with a piece of paper that had, they figured out it was a Stardust because it had some totals. So the take from the craps, or I believe the slot machines and I believe the craps tables and the cards tables or something. But it had three figures, and they went out to the Las Vegas casinos, and it wasn't that big a deal in 1951 or 52. And they matched the totals of the Tropicana exactly to those numbers that he had written on that piece of paper in his pocket. So they were really heavily into the casinos back then.
Yeah, yeah. And this, you know, it is. I've read in a couple places that when they were passing the gambling laws in 1930-31, when they were building the Hoover Dam, that was that Capone and. Capone and his numbers guy.
Jake Guzik.
They did a lot of lobbying. They really pushed for the legalized gambling in Vegas because that was when they were building the Hoover Dam. They wanted to reach out and get a couple things established out there. They really saw it as an opportunity. And up until there were some casinos built in the later time before, right around the time Bugsy Siegel got there, and a little bit before, there were Chicago guys who had a presence, and it was Siegel who really decided the casinos could be a major factor out there, but Chicago had a smaller presence, and they apparently really lobbied for the casino legalization. So the mob and gambling, whether it's Atlantic City or Las Vegas, it's just, and you know, even in Havana, it's just the mob and legalized gambling is just, that's just where it is.
Yeah, really. I guess to kind of wrap this up, I guess it was an open city. Las Vegas was an open city for Chicago or the East Coast, any mob family to try to have some action going, and anybody could do whatever they're big enough to do. But then after this meeting, then it became delineated between Atlantic City and Las Vegas. Would you say that? Would you agree with that, Cam?
It sounds like this was the official nail in the coffin. I think it was trending that direction. But once Atlantic City came into play, they really wanted to draw the line in the sand and say, I think that New York had basically been out of Vegas for a while, but they wanted to really, really delineate them and really put the final nail in the coffin and say, all right, you guys don't come to Atlantic City and we will absolutely stay out of Las Vegas. But like you said, you guys were exercising search warrants and everything. So basically, Chicago was more or less leaving Las Vegas, as it were. And so they weren't going to be in Vegas anyway. But New York did not want Chicago reaching into Atlantic City. So this meeting was what made it official. And it was big, having seven different mafia groups present. That's just major. The only commission members that weren't there were Detroit and Buffalo, but you had every other commission member. I don't, the patriarchs were not there, but that was just their thing. They didn't really have a dog in a fight. Yeah. But every other group represented in the country was at this meeting, basically.
Oh, interesting. Well, this has been great, Cam. I appreciate you digging this up and bringing this to my attention, and I could add my humble little opinions and my little bit of experience I had with this casino skimming thing, and you know, Las Vegas, it just like died out. Las Vegas, it just died out for everybody after the search warrants were served, and everybody went to jail in the later middle '80s, and I don't know what happened in Atlantic City. I'm assuming that they have continued to make some money out of different ways out of Atlantic City. But
I'm sure.
It's changed so much. Well, you know, then Donald Trump came in and kicked them all out, I guess. I don't know. then the bankruptcy court kicked him out.
That's right.
So I've been to Atlantic City. It's kind of sad and tired looking compared to Las Vegas, and it just never really developed. And then back east, I understand there's so many of these big Indian casinos that they've got located up close in major cities like Boston and even out right out, not too far out in New York City. You don't have to take a 4-hour bus trip down to get to Atlantic City.
Right. Right.
So everything changes. All right, Cam, I appreciate it. Folks, if you have a friend or relative, with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. Or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. Don't forget to hit me up on the Venmo app, buy me a cup of coffee or a shot and a beer, help me with these out-of-pocket expenses. These things, they're not a lot, but they're a little bit every month. And you know, with Cam, a good thing Skype's free, huh, Cam?
That's right.
Skype to Skype's free, folks. We'll do a little ad for Skype. And if you're a cigar smoker, remember, when you go outside to smoke your cigar, listen to the podcast. And when you're with other cigar smokers, say, you know, here's what I do. I go outside and smoke my cigar and listen to Gangland Wire. Best podcast ever.
That's right.
And if you want to catch my movie, you can get it for $1.99 as a download from Amazon. I've got the Kansas City Mob Tour app and the Apple Store. What else? Oh, I got my book, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. And I suggest you get the Kindle version because I connected a whole bunch of the actual audio from the wiretaps to the book. All you got to do is tap on the link and you go right to an actual audio and listen to the out of the mouths of the men that did it, right, Cam?
That's incredible. That's an incredible feature.
I know. I couldn't believe I thought of that, and I haven't ever seen anything else like it.
No, hell no.
It was a lot of work, but it was worth it. It was worth it. Absolutely. People seemed to enjoy it. All right. I don't know if I got anything else to say, folks. Thanks a lot for supporting the podcast. And you know, they say to give us, if you got an Apple iPhone, give us a review in Apple, or hit me up on Venmo, and you'll get a mention on the podcast. Thanks a lot, Cam. Talk to you later.
Absolutely, Gary. Night.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.